Hello, everyone. Dan Dillman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Welcome today. Thanks for joining 101.5, where we bring you entertainment, information, and once in a while, we may even make you smile. Today's first item is about curling. You may have seen curling, perhaps in the Olympic Games. I wanted to tell you just a little bit about this. To us, might seem like a strange game. Well, icy fingers and warm hearts, curlers love the rink life. At a frigid ice rink in Wayland, Massachusetts, members of the Brimstones Curling Club look for a clean push-off, as they say, that will send a 44-pound stone gliding more than 100 feet across the ice and closest to the target. And the target is called the house. Some say it's like bocce ball, but it's more like playing chess, according to Rich Collier. He's the vice president of the Brimstones. He said, I might do something now that will benefit three or four shots from now. It's all about building it up and sequencing. Curling, which started in the 16th century Scotland, may look puzzling to the uninitiated. There are two teams, and they take turns making throws. And perhaps throws is not appropriate when you see them play this game, but it's more like pushing, because the player will take hold of the stone and literally push it down the ice. But anyway, in the parlance of curlers, they call it throwing. So the two teams take turns making throws, and their teammates sweep the ice in front of them. And that's so that the stone will travel farther, and the stone actually curves or curls, and that's what gives the sport its name. The team with the stones closest to the center wins the round. You see, the ice is divided into two parts by a strip across the ice, and there are circles in either end, which the teams throw their stones toward. There are 8 to 10 rounds in a full match. The team having the closest to the center wins the round. The team with the most points wins the match. Well, since it was added to the Olympic Winter Games in 1998, the sport has grown in popularity, and today there are more than 80 clubs in the United States. And at Brimstones, the wait for a membership is 5 years. After the match in Wayland, both of the teams would meet in the lodge for refreshments. The evening ends in smiles and handshakes. The easiest part about curling is having fun, says Mr. Collier. The hardest part is not taking yourself too seriously. Well, in 2009, a group of dedicated curlers who couldn't travel to Brimstones opened the Ocean State Curling Club in Smithfield, Rhode Island. The one thing that people should know about curling is that anyone can do it, according to the club's president. He says new players can be curling in a league or two, hours perhaps. That little amount of instruction would qualify you to engage in this sport. It's just a really social sport. They enjoy losing at curling more than they enjoy winning at almost any other sport. Sounds kind of odd to us, I know. Curling is a heavy-handed sport, so to speak. And what I mean by that is that the curling stones are made of granite and they weigh around 40 pounds. Also, the curlers wear special footwear. There are shoes of two types, and these have different soles. One is necessary for sticking to the ice, and the other allows sliding on the ice. And so, to end this segment, let me just remind you that curling is a social sport, it's a fun sport, and you get to throw granite up and down the ice. You listen for instructions from your captain, who's known as the skip. From the far side of the rink, he yells out the instructions, and the players sweep the ice in order to reduce friction, enabling this hunk of granite to slide more easily, enabling the stone to travel farther. So if you're interested in curling, you might want to read about it in this article in the Christian Science Monitor Weekly on the week of March 6th. I thought it was kind of amusing, and that's why I wanted to share it with you. And now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about school bus. The school bus, the invention of and the development of a school bus. The westward expansion and urbanization of the 19th century left clusters of families scattered across rural America with only muddy ruts and a rudimentary web of roads to connect them. So in order to attend school, children had to walk for miles, or else, if they were lucky, they might catch a ride on a passing horse-drawn wagon. The seasonal nature of farm work and the lack of public transportation often meant that many children couldn't go to school year-round. But in 1852, Massachusetts passed a compulsory education law, and by 1900, 31 other states had similar requirements. There was a problem, however. If the state was going to mandate that children attend school, the kids would have to get there. And schools responded by trundling children to and from school or in horse-drawn conveyances that were called kid hacks or school wagons. These rickety rides went on for decades, and not all parents were pleased. In May of 1897, and Mrs. W.B. Ashley of Fall River, Mass., argued that the town needed to build a new school since one of her children was unwell because she was unable to eat her dinners as the child's stomach was deranged by the jolting of the wagon. This, according to a local newspaper at the time. American families' need for school transport begat a hodgepodge of solutions. And in 1892, Wayne Works, an automotive company in Indiana, developed its horse-drawn school car for a school district in Ohio. It had a single entrance in the back and long wooden benches along the sides. By 1914, the company was producing a motorized school car. It looked like a mashup between a Model T and a trolley car, and would enjoy decades-long reign as one of the top producers of school transport in the country. However, the hollowing out of America's rural landscape accelerated once more during the Great Depression. And as the educational historian Campbell Scribner writes in his 2016 book, The Fight for Local Control, school consolidation drove the necessity for the school bus. Even with the buses, though, inequities remained. Farm kids, for example, often couldn't get, they couldn't stick around for sports if they had to catch the bus. And so there were problems in this respect. And while Wayne Works maintained a prominent share of the market throughout the Depression, Albert Luce Sr., owner of two Ford dealerships in Georgia, was innovating his own bus. Beginning in 1925, Luce first attached a wooden body to a truck frame, but the invention threatened to fall apart as it rattled on unpaved rural roads. So Luce added a steel frame beneath the wooden body, and this provided stability. Still, safety remained a problem. And in 1935, a number of school bus accidents convinced Luce that he needed to start using all steel bodies. And by the end of the 1940s, Luce's company, Bluebird, had become a prolific bus manufacturer. And though Wayne Works is out of business, Bluebird is alive and well, billing itself as the leading U.S. manufacturer of school buses, having sold 550,000 since 1922. Many say that Wayne Works was the first to develop the steel frame. There is some argument about that, though. Bluebird's inaugural bus sits now in the Henry Ford Museum as the oldest surviving school bus. Yet national standards were still lacking, and this was a problem that was recognized by a teacher, Frank Sear, who spent his career in various rural public schools in Nebraska and beyond. In 1937, however, Sear conducted a study of school conveyances from trucks to buses and even those old-fashioned wagons. And 2 years later, at the first conference dedicated to improving school buses, he hung paint samples on the wall and tapped a small group of attendees to choose a uniform color for U.S. school buses. The winner was, you guessed it, bright yellow. And the reason that it was chosen was it was the easiest color on which to read the vehicle's black lettering. Now the yellow bus is about to go environmentally green. The American School Bus Council estimates that over 25 million school children ride more than 480,000 school buses each day, making school buses the largest mass transit system in America. As of last year, fewer than 1,200 of those buses were electric, but with a $5 billion investment from the 2021 bipartisan infrastructure law, that number could rise to at least 10,000 by 2026. Ever since Virginia added 50 electric buses to its fleet in 2020, the Commonwealth has already saved more than 500,000 pounds of carbon emissions. The new buses will fulfill a historic role. The future of buses, according to many people in this industry, is the future of American children. And with that, we're going to take a short break. Please don't go away. We'll be back shortly. Here we are again. We're talking about artificial intelligence. And this time, artificial intelligence gets literary. I'm going to tell you a bit about ChatGPT. Advances in artificial intelligence have long stirred ethical debates about intellectual and creativity property rights. But the recent arrival of ChatGPT, which is a search engine Chatbot launched in November of 2022, has turbo boosted those existential questions across classrooms and executive suites alike. Big tech is spurring the momentum behind a wave of user-friendly AI tools. One is called OpenAI, which is the parent company behind ChatGPT, previously made by DALL-E, an AI that generates digital images from written queries. In late January, OpenAI secured a multi-billion dollar investment from Microsoft for ChatGPT. Its newest groundbreaking algorithm, which is capable of crafting convincing prose in response to various prompts. Well, just how does ChatGPT work? And for the uninitiated, GPT is capitalized. Chat, capital C-H-A-T, GPT, GPT. It's hard to say. It is currently available for free at OpenAI's website. About 100 million people used ChatGPT in January, according to one estimate, and that would be the fastest growing user base ever. Once registered with an email account on the website, a user can start a text conversation with ChatGPT and receive results within seconds. The machine is fast and prolific, generating answers and expanding upon ideas on screen. First prompts for ChatGPT might be simple, like, what's the square root of 324? Or give me the history of the United States. Or write an essay about the Bermuda Triangle. The bigger the questions come, what is GPT? The ChatGPT is a language model which was developed by OpenAI that uses advanced artificial intelligence to generate human-like text. ChatGPT responded to such a prompt. In simple terms, it is a program that can understand and generate text like a human by learning patterns in language from vast amounts of text data. And now here comes the good part. It can even write poems about scanning groceries at the self-checkout according to the style of William Shakespeare. For better or worse, here we go. O wondrous machine with thy buttons and beeps, thou art a marvel of technology's leap. At the self-checkout, I do stand in awe as I scan each item and watch as thou dost saw. Thy sensors doth read each barcode with care, and the numbers doth appear with nimble repair. I place each item within my basket fare and watch as thou dost count with neither flaw nor snare. And that's today's contribution for literary artificial intelligence. Get used to it. I think you're going to see more of this in the future, the near future. We'll pause for just a bit, and I'll be back shortly with some closing items for today's program. Don't go away, please. We want you here. A couple of items before we end today's show, then. Question I've been wondering about for a while. Where did the Union Army get the blue to dye its uniforms during the Civil War? Well, the Union Army dyed its fabric with indigo, a plant that once grew abundantly in South Carolina, but it declined steeply by the late 1700s. During the Civil War, the Union Army had to import indigo primarily from India by way of Great Britain. And as the demand for uniforms rose, the army began using cheaper dyes for the thread that held the fabric together. Prussian blue was synthetic and manufactured domestically. Logwood, a natural dye, came from tropical plants and was easy to obtain from sources in the Western Hemisphere. So if you've been wondering about that, there is the answer. And finally, do American Indians have a written language? The first to have a written system were the Timucuia, though it was developed by Francisco Pareja, a Franciscan missionary who came to St. Augustine, Florida. In 1595, later, in 1891, Sequoia, a Cherokee Indian, created a set of written characters to form the first written native language using characters. This allowed reading, writing, and later printing to prosper in the Cherokee Nation. Today, many tribes in the United States, including the Navajo, have phonetically adapted their spoken languages using the Latin alphabet. It's about time for us to consider leaving today. The clock on the wall is always our enemy as I'm doing the show. And so today, I want to wish you well. Hope you keep safe. Be kind to each other. Going to be a very interesting month in terms of weather. We've had a strange winter this year. Certainly the result of our changing climates. So, my friend Willie Nelson and I wish you well. We're going to head down that road again, looking for things that would be appropriate to put on the program. And one of those, next week, we're going to do something about the Erie Canal. And I keep saying that we're going to talk about the last frontier, according to Frederick Jackson Turner. And we'll be starting that very soon as well. And so, friends, please come back. Join us at 101.5. And we'll inform, entertain you, and I hope make you smile once in a while. Today, it's goodbye to live.